try being happy for me sometime." She squared her shoulders and walked away before he could reply. Calliope. Calliope walked eagerly through the Nuage lobby, which on this sunny afternoon was all soaring white and blue, making the hotel live up to its name. She felt like she was floating through the center of a cloud, maybe of Mount Olympus. In the nick of time, she remembered her fake limp, for the benefit of the front desk managers. The last thing she and Elise needed was to start being charged for the room they had no intention of paying for. But Calliope could hardly think straight. She was heading to afternoon tea with her mom, and her stomach was bubbling with a pleasant sense of anticipation. For Calliope and her mom, afternoon tea always meant something. She turned into the hotel's formal dining room, which was lined with gilded paneling, its delicate tables covered in wisp-thin linens, and set with antique Francis I sterling. Young girls in bright pink bows squirmed in their seats, accompanied by harried moms. Groups of women clinked champagne glasses. There were even a few tourists, eyeing the society crowd with trepidation and a degree of envy. Calliope found her mom at a table in the middle of the room. "Of course," Calliope thought, unsurprised and amused. "All the better for being admired." "What's the occasion?" she asked, settling into the opposite seat.
"The occasion is I'm taking my daughter out for tea."
Elise smiled, looking cool and careless in a printed sheath. Calliope leaned back. "Every time we do this, it reminds me of Princess Day," she said, her tone reflective but not quite wistful. Calliope had been obsessed with tea ever since she was a little girl, when she and her friend Dara would put on Justine's hand-me-down clothes and serve each other water in plain white mugs, calling each other made-up names like Lady Thistledown and Lady Pennyfeather. Elise had picked up on the fixation and started an annual tradition, just her and Calliope, called Princess Day. It instantly became Calliope's favorite day of the year. On Princess Day, Elise and Calliope would dress up, sometimes even carrying Mrs. Houghton's purses, or wearing her scarves or jewelry. It was the only occasion when Elise would let them do so, and go to the Savoy Hotel for its expensive afternoon tea. Even at that age, Calliope had known that it was willfully stupid of them to do something so extravagant, something they clearly couldn't afford. But they needed Princess Day. It was a chance for the two of them to escape their routines and step into someone else's life, just for a moment. And Calliope could tell that her mother loved it as much as she did, being the one catered to, for once, rather than the other way around. She loved being presented with a silver tray of delicate little sweets and being asked which she would like, and she would lift her ring-crusted finger and say in an imperious tone, "That one, and that one, and also that," commanding someone else the way that Mrs. Houghton constantly commanded her. Calliope would never forget the way her mom had turned to her that first morning on the train to Russia, when their old life was long gone and their new one just unfolding.
"It's Princess Day, sweetheart," she'd said.
Calliope shook her head in confusion.
"But we had one a few months ago."
"Every day is Princess Day now," Elise had said with a smile. Not the pinched, forced smile she'd worn for so long, but a genuine, easy smile, and Calliope saw that her mother was shedding some terrible skin she'd been forced into, and becoming someone new. As the years went on, she would realize that Elise had never been happy in London. It wasn't until their life on the road that she'd seemed to find her true calling. Even now, tea was still their tradition, as cherished and as sacred as any church. Calliope loved the ceremony of it being poured, hot and steaming, into a shape-shifting china cup, the beautiful array of fluffy scones and clotted cream and fancifully cut sandwiches. There was something soothing about the ritual of high tea. No matter where you went in the world, it was always stuffy and traditional and comfortingly British. Whenever they had a big decision to make, Calliope and Elise would do so at afternoon tea at whatever five-star hotel they'd conned their way into. It was how they chose when to move locations, how much cash Elise should try to swindle from her latest boyfriend or girlfriend, when they should get their next retinas replaced. It was how they made every important choice, Calliope realized, except her decision to get involved with Atlas. That was the only real choice she'd made on her own. Just then, a waitress with a turned-up nose and jaunty ponytail approached their table. She looked younger than Calliope. Actually, Calliope thought, she seemed familiar, though she couldn't have said why. "Good afternoon, ladies. Are you familiar with our tea menu?" she asked smoothly. A holographic scroll shimmered in the air before them both, with the menu written in calligraphy. Calliope could see the edge of each droplet of ink, the glitter that seemed dusted over it all. "We'll have the classic tea tower and lemon water, no tea," Elise said briskly, waving her arm through the scroll so that its refracted pixels dissolved into nothing. The waitress smiled. "Tea is complimentary with your tower. We have teas from every nation on Earth and several off-planet as..." "Whatever is your favorite," Calliope said quickly, then lifted an eyebrow at her mom as the girl scurried away. "Come on. I know we're celebrating something. What did this Nadav guy give you?" Elise shrugged. "Show tickets. A funny little invention of his that tracks your heartbeat and muscle movements. Nothing of any real value." "But he's asked for a family dinner soon," she added, her tone lowering several octaves. Calliope understood in a flash what today's tea was about. She was being scolded, very lightly, with a lot of sugar and fanfare, but a scolding nonetheless. "You want me to be friendlier with Livia." "I'm not asking for much, but it would have meant a lot to me if you'd put in just a teensy bit of effort with her at the ball," Elise sighed. "I thought you were going to play backup for me, but you went off focused on your own thing." "I was with a date, Mum," Calliope pointed out. Elise threw her hands up in a conciliatory gesture. "I get it, I get it. I know you like running your own little side cons." "They aren't little," Calliope thought, slightly peeved. "And I never tell you no, do I? I think I've been more than fair," her mom went on. Calliope shrugged. "Of course I'll do a family dinner," she promised, as if she hadn't done a million of them in the past, some ending with a wedding ring, others not. She wondered how quickly her mom would wrangle a proposal out of this relationship. But Elise wasn't finished. "I was hoping that you could play a little less loose when we're at dinner," she suggested. "Act more like Livia."
"You mean act boring," Calliope pointed out.
"Exactly," Elise laughed. The waitress deposited an opulent display of treats on their table. It tapered upward like the real tower, complete with a miniature sugar spire. "This is lunar tea," she said, pouring a steaming mug of tea that smelled vaguely like aloe. "My favorite. It's grown on the moon's surface. The plants see a much weaker sun, so their growing season is twice as long." Calliope took a tentative sip from the mug, which, sensing the tea inside, had shifted into a golden half-moon shape. She immediately spit it back, disgusted by the bitter taste. The waitress pursed her lips at her reaction, as if holding back a smile. And Calliope suddenly wondered whether the younger girl hadn't recommended the revolting tea on purpose, just to screw with what she likely thought was a pair of entitled, rude women. It was the kind of thing Calliope would have done, if she'd been in that girl's shoes. She glanced down at her chic printed skirt and the fuchsia Sen Rev bag perched next to her chair. Did this girl think of her the way Calliope used to think about Justine Houghton? But she was nothing like Justine Houghton. "Does that waitress remind you of someone?" she blurted out after the girl had walked away.
"I don't think so."
Elise was reaching around the offending tea for her water glass, with a cheerful slice of lemon floating on top. "Now tell me more about your progress.
It's clearly going well since you didn't even come home until Sunday morning.
I'm not so sure, Calliope said, her usual confidence faltering.
She didn't know what to make of the situation with Atlas. She had tried to scout around the Fuller's apartment a little later that night, but almost all the rooms had no guest settings on their doorways. And she hadn't really been in the mood to steal a random antique off a tabletop. She wanted something bigger. She wanted jewelry, but she had a feeling she might never get any from Atlas. He'd been perfectly nice the morning after that party, sitting and eating breakfast with her, even calling her a hover home. But Calliope could see that his mind was elsewhere. Maybe he regretted letting her come over the night before. Not that anything had even happened between them. Atlas had been so drunk that he promptly passed out, leaving Calliope to sneak around their apartment uninhibited. Eventually, she'd come back to his room and found a t-shirt of his before drifting off on the other side of the bed, alone.
"I can see why. That boy is almost too gorgeous to con."
It was a moment before Calliope realized her mom meant Bryce Anderton.
"Oh, I just used Bryce for an invite to the party. He's not connable," she said quickly, knowing that Elise wouldn't push it. "No, I'm targeting a different boy. He's the one I went home with."
She looked down at her hands, nervously slicing a cucumber sandwich into tiny triangles. Her mom always seemed to understand what other people were thinking, what they wanted. Maybe she would have some insight into Atlas.
"Actually, I could use your advice," Calliope admitted.
Elise leaned forward eagerly.
"What else are moms for?"
Calliope told her everything, about how she'd recognized Atlas at the Fuller's cocktail party and staged a run-in with him at the Nuage pool, then accepted Bryce's invitation to the Hudson Conservancy Ball, knowing that Atlas would be at the same party. How she'd gone home with Atlas, proving once and for all her conviction that he did want her, only to realize that maybe she'd been wrong.
"Let me get this straight," Elise said, reaching for a bite of scone.
Tiny sugar-flecked pieces crumbled down, sparkling like scattered gems against the china plate.
"You met this boy in Africa?"
Calliope nodded.
"But then he left me one day, with no explanation. I never told you because..." "It's all right," Elise said quickly.
They didn't talk much about that con in India, the worst one they'd ever done. Elise had gotten involved with an older gentleman who worked in the government and solicited a donation to a fake charity organization. But then the old man had died, all of a sudden, under mysterious circumstances. Suddenly, the country's entire police force had been after them. It had been so terrifying that Calliope and Elise had split up as they fled the country. Just in case.
"I just didn't realize you ran a con in Africa,"
her mom went on, sounding a little hurt.
"It doesn't matter, because it didn't work."
"Yet. It didn't work yet,"
Elise corrected. She gave a narrow smile, her eyes glinting like a cat's.
"It's a longer con than you'd expected, but who cares? You can afford to play a long game."
"Not too long. He's moving away soon." It was less than a month before Atlas went to Dubai to run his dad's tower there. She had to get something from him before that happened.
"Well, don't worry if it doesn't work out. I'll get enough for the both of us,"
Elise promised and sighed.
"You did say this boy comes from money, right?"
"He's Atlas Fuller." Hadn't Calliope said that already?
"That cocktail party was at his family's apartment."
Elise froze like a character in a Hollow game, an iced cake lifted halfway to her lips. The only movement was the slow, stunned blink of her gold-shadowed eyes. For a moment, Calliope worried she'd gone too far, that maybe it wasn't such a good idea trying to con the boy whose family literally lived on top of the world. But then Elise was laughing, so hard that tears gathered at the corners of her eyes. Seeing it made Calliope laugh, too.
"The 1000th floor! Let it never be said that you don't aim high. Cheers to that!" Elise clinked their water glasses with renewed purpose.
What can I say? I have expensive taste, Calliope conceded with a smile.
Her mom was right. Calliope was a pro, and she always landed her mark in the end. She would land Atlas, too, no matter how long it took. The waitress came over to collect their tea tray, scattered with smears of butter and half-eaten tarts. In a flash of insight, Calliope knew who the waitress had reminded her of. Dara, her childhood friend. She had the same chestnut hair and wide-set eyes. She wondered what Dara was up to now, all these years later.
"Do you want to get the check this time, or should I?"
Elise asked.
"We can't pay with the BitBank money. I thought our last payout was a big one."
Surely they hadn't spent all that money so fast. The thought of doing one of their tricks right now felt strangely wearying.
Elise shrugged. "We blew through most of that money on our girls' week in Monaco."
Calliope cringed at the thought of that extravagant trip, with shopping sprees and decadent hotels and a boat they'd rented on a whim. Maybe they should have been a little more responsible.
"I'm trying to save the rest for our tickets out of here," her mom added. "But don't worry. I'll get our tea."
She glanced around, then reached over to yank out a few of Calliope's hairs.
"Hey, ow!"
Calliope cursed. She wanted to clap a hand to her head, but she knew it would ruin the con.
"You didn't bring anything with you?"
she hissed under her breath.
"Sorry. I'd use mine, but they aren't nearly dark enough to pass for the waitresses."
Elise started to place the hairs on a plate, then thought better of it, and curled them in the bottom of the teacup. She leaned back, draping a pale arm carelessly over the back of the chair as she took a sip of the previously untouched tea. An instant later, she let out an affected shriek, a hand lifted to her chest. Heads swiveled automatically in their direction. The waitress, who looked like a grown-up version of Dara, hurried over.
"Oh my God! There's hair in my tea!"
Elise cried out, her tone dripping with revulsion. Her eyes lifted accusatorily to the waitress.
"You shed into my tea!"
More glances kept shooting their way. New Yorkers did love drama, Calliope reflected, as long as they weren't the ones causing a scene.
"I'm so sorry,"
the waitress stammered, reaching up hesitantly toward the crown of her head as if to confirm that her hair was up in a slick, high ponytail. Her expression was one of unmasked fear. During the ensuing familiar hubbub of calling a manager, complaining, getting their meal comped, Calliope said nothing. She found herself wondering what would happen to the waitress when this was all over. Probably she would have her wages docked for the amount of their tea, Calliope thought, shifting a little in her chair. Surely she wouldn't be fired, right?
"You okay?"
Elise asked when it was all over and they stepped into the elevator back up to their suite.
"You look pale." "I think I ate too much sugar."
Calliope put a hand on her stomach, which was, in fact, aching.
"I'll be fine."
But as the doors closed, revealing the gleaming, mirrored interior of the Nuages elevator, Calliope looked down at her hands clasped tight around the handle of her purse. For once, she didn't really feel like admiring her own reflection. Avery. Avery lay on her bed, staring up at the delicate clouds that floated across her ceiling without seeing them. It had been several days since she'd come home to find Calliope in the kitchen, wearing Atlas's boxers, though she wouldn't ever forget the image. It was burned into her mind with such searing clarity. She and Atlas hadn't spoken since that morning. She hadn't even seen him in the apartment. They'd both made themselves scarce lately, as if they'd agreed to some mutual, temporary ceasefire. Somehow Avery had managed to hold it together at school. But every night she'd collapsed into her champagne-colored lace pillows and let herself erupt in hot, bitter tears. "Avery?" She shouldn't have been surprised that he was knocking on her door, but still, it took a moment for Avery to process what was happening. She'd been longing for this conversation, yet she'd been dreading it, too.
Unlock, she muttered, standing up as the room comp released the magnetic block field from over her door. Atlas stood there. He looked different. There were circles around his eyes and a pallor to his skin. But it was more than that. Something had fundamentally changed about him, as if he was no longer the boy Avery thought he was.
Hey,
she said simply. Let him give the next syllable. That was all she had to offer right now.
Hey,
Atlas echoed. His eyes searched hers, but she just returned his stare, cool and level.
Look, can I come in?
He asked. Avery stepped aside and he walked past her, shutting the door.
Took you long enough, she muttered.
I had a lot to think about.
But Avery wasn't finished.
I assume so. You really screwed up this time, Atlas.
I'm sorry, I screwed up? Don't you hear yourself? You came back that morning from Cord's. Who are you to talk?
You know full well that Cord and I are just friends.
Avery felt oddly pleased to have made him shout.
I don't know anything anymore, Atlas replied, with a bitterness that surprised her.
They were standing beneath an enormous crystal chandelier, utterly still. It was as if the act of finally having this conversation had anchored them to the ground, and neither of them could move until they resolved things one way or another. Avery bit her lip, wishing she'd rehearsed some kind of speech.
Look, I'm sorry about how I reacted when I saw you flirting with Calliope. It was stupid and immature. I came back that morning wanting to tell you I was sorry, but then I found her, prancing around in your underwear.
She blinked back a fresh onslaught of tears.
Atlas, I know we fought, but you didn't have to sleep with her that same night.
Nothing happened between me and Calliope, Atlas insisted. Not that you'll believe me, since you seem determined to think exactly what you want.
Avery sighed.
Even if you didn't sleep with her, you shouldn't have brought her home. Don't you see? When something bad happened, you went straight to her. You ran away.
To someone easier, someone you could actually be with in public, she wanted to add.
It wasn't just me. We both ran away to someone else.
Like I said, nothing happened between me and Cord.
Avery wasn't quite sure why she wanted to make the point, but it didn't matter. Atlas was shaking his head.
I believe you. But what about next time, Aves? Maybe something will happen then, for either of us. Don't you see what a huge problem it is that when we fought, we both turned to someone else, someone more...
easy. Uncomplicated. Which is exactly what you and I are not.
She finished for him. Atlas looked up at her.
Is that why you love me?
He asked very quietly. At first she didn't understand.
What? Did you fall in love with me because it was complicated and forbidden? Because I was the only thing in the entire world that you were ever denied? The only thing you ever wanted that you were told no instead of yes?
Avery felt the blood drain from her face.
That's cruel, Atlas. You don't mean that.
At the hurt in her voice, something of the old Atlas came back to his features, and he let out a breath.
I had to ask, he replied,
sounding more defeated than upset. It scared Avery because she knew it meant he was shutting himself away from her, forcing himself not to feel, not to care.
You know I love you, she insisted.
And you know I love you. After all this, though...
Avery heard the note of finality in his voice, and she realized, with a terrifying sense of clarity, that it was the beginning of the end.
It isn't working, is it?
She said quietly, because the words were so very painful, and Atlas shouldn't have to be the one to say them.
It can't ever work. It's impossible. Aves, it might be best for us to just... stop.
Atlas spoke hollowly, almost formally, as though Avery were a client to whom he was proposing a new construction plan. But Avery knew his mind better almost than she knew her own. She could see what this was doing to him, the excruciating effort he was making to keep from breaking down in front of her. "I love you and nothing else matters," she wanted to say, but she held the words back. Because in the end, they weren't useful. Everything else mattered. She loved Atlas, and Atlas loved her, and yet it would never work between them. She knew the events of last Saturday were her fault. She depicted their relationship, peeling off little pieces of it like a destructive child, until it all inevitably came to a head. But their problem was bigger than that one evening. Atlas was right. What had happened was just a symptom of the larger issue, the sheer impossibility of them being together. There was nowhere they could go that was safe. Nowhere that the truth of who they were, the forbiddenness of their love, wouldn't come chasing them. Maybe love wasn't enough after all. Not when every last obstacle was arrayed against you, all the odds stacked to make you fail. When the entire world was keeping you apart. "Okay," Avery said, as the universe quietly rent itself in two. "Let's just... I mean..." She couldn't finish the sentence. "Let's just go back to the way things were before? Go back to being brother and sister after everything they had shared?" Atlas seemed to understand her, the way he always did.
"I'm going to take the Dubai job. I'll be halfway around the world soon. That should make it easier on you. I'm sorry," he added.
She wasn't sure how long she stood there after he left, her eyes still closed. A single tear ran down her cheek. It felt to Avery as if someone had died. And in some sense, there had been a death, she thought, of her relationship with Atlas. It had been a living, breathing thing, full of sound and color, until the two of them just dealt it the final blow. Atlas was leaving. And he wasn't coming back. Lita sat in bed, trying to catch up on her reading for English class, but her mind was racing too fast to focus on the words. She couldn't stop thinking about what and what had happened on Saturday night. She'd woken the next morning to find nothing but rumpled bed covers, Watt already gone. Then she'd remembered everything. The press of his mouth on hers, the strong, certain way his hands had traveled over her body. And she'd rolled over to bury her face in her pillow, stifling a groan. Thank God she hadn't let it go too far. What had she been thinking, bringing home Watt Bacrati? She didn't even like him. Might, in fact, detest him. Well, she decided crisply, at least not liking him meant that it would be easy to erase this whole incident. No need to bring it up ever again. Except that, even now, she couldn't hold back the memories flashing hot and bright through her mind, faster and faster. She closed her eyes against them, but that just made them come more quickly. "Lita?" her mom said, pushing open her bedroom door. "I thought we agreed that you were going to start knocking." Lita couldn't help being immediately on the defensive. She hoped the flush on her cheeks didn't somehow betray what she'd just been thinking about. Her mom wandered over to her closet, tapping angrily through the clothing display on Lita's touchscreen. She'd always found a strange comfort in clothes, as if by organizing the single perfect outfit she could ward off all the unpleasantness of life. "I'm worried about you," Ilara said, still looking at the screen. She was wearing silk pajamas that were covered in printed chickens, which for some reason struck Lita as absurdly comical. "I've been worried since before Eris died, which is why we're going to your check-in at Silver Cove next weekend, just you and me." Lita jumped out of bed, startled. "What? No!" Lita didn't want to go back there, especially not with her mom. "Lita, the 4-month follow-up is a recommended part of your treatment. I think it would be good for you, given everything that's been going on.
Dr. Vandersteen agrees with me.
God, Mom, you have got to stop discussing me with him. It is completely unethical.
Lita cried out. She took a deep breath and tried to regain a measure of calm.
I don't need to go, I promise.
Lita couldn't bear the thought of returning to Silver Cove. It was crowded with too many memories. If she went back, she would be forced to confront everything that had happened in the past few months. Would have to remember the Lita Cole who'd first shown up there, young and wounded and still in love with Atlas. That girl may have been stupid, but at least she was better than this new Lita, who had killed someone, then blackmailed others into lying about it. Lita was afraid, she realized, of the ghost of her former self. Her mom sighed, and this time her tone was firm.
I know you've been lying to me.
Lita's heart raced. The mirrors in her closet made it seem as though there were three of Ilara, all of them reprimanding her daughter in the same disappointed tone.
You tell me that you're going to Avery's all the time, but then I hear from Elizabeth Fuller that you haven't stopped by in weeks. What's going on that you aren't telling me?
Her mom went on, defeated. Lita stepped forward and pulled her mom into a hug. Her poor, sweet, trusting mom, who still didn't know that Lita's dad had cheated on her, who just wanted the best for her children.
I'm sorry, Lita murmured, trying desperately to buy time. I love you.
Ilara was so thin that Lita could feel each bone in her spine, all stacked on one another like curved puzzle pieces.
Please, Lita. Whatever it is, I promise I want to help. I, of all people, have no room to judge.
Ilara said softly, and now she sounded close to tears.
After all, it's my fault you got into this mess to begin with.
Lita blinked, momentarily startled by her own insensitivity. She'd never considered that her mom might blame herself for Lita's addiction. It had been Ilara's Zenperhydrin that Lita had started popping back in seventh grade, when she first realized what they were. Her mom's were legal, of course, prescribed for anxiety by none other than Dr. Vandersteen. But still. If there was no way out of this rehab check-in, then at the very least, Lita needed to go without her mom. It would be too emotionally taxing for Ilara. Lita couldn't ask that of her.
I'll go by myself, she offered, but her mom shook her head.
You need an accountability partner there with you.
What about Dad?
Lita's heart leapt in wild panic.
Absolutely not. There was no way in hell she was spending an entire weekend alone with her dad. All those lectures and sharing circles. He might try to talk to her about Eris again, make some bizarre confession to relieve his own conscience, all under the guise of healing.
And then Lita realized exactly who she should ask. Someone who couldn't make any demands of her, who would let her go to yoga and holo screenings instead of all the actual rehab activities. Someone who couldn't tell her no.
You were right, Mom. I have been keeping something from you.
Here it was, the gamble. Nothing ventured, nothing gained, right?
I have a new boyfriend.
Sure enough, Ilara gave a sharp intake of breath, pleased to be proven right.
Boyfriend? Who is he?
Wat Bakrati. I brought him to the Hudson Conservancy Ball. He lives down towers, so I thought... She purposefully let the silence drag out.
What? That I wouldn't approve?
Lita shrugged, letting her mom take that as a yes.
Come on, Lita. I hope you think better of me than that.
I came from nothing, too.
Ilara reached for Lita's hands and gave her a firm, well-meaning squeeze.
Thank you.
Lita exhaled in relief.
So I was hoping Watt could come to the rehab check-in with me instead.
Her mom still frowned.
I'm happy that you found Watt, but I'm not sure he's the right person to bring to Silver Cove. You haven't been dating him that long. He's not equipped to talk about your history.
I would feel much better if your father went instead.
Lita looked down as if embarrassed, digging herself further in, burying herself under more lies.
Watt does know my history. And he's known me for a while, actually. It's just a sensitive subject, because of how I met him.
What do you mean?
His older sister went to Silver Cove. She went through something similar.
Lita's stomach twisted at the lie, but then she thought again of going back there, of seeing the old familiar places, and worse, what it might do to her mom, and her resolve hardened.
Watt's been my accountability partner recently. After everything that happened with his sister, it's important to him to be part of my healing process, and it would mean a lot to me to have him there.
Ilara was silent for a moment, studying Lita as if she wasn't quite sure what to make of this new development.
Let me discuss this with your father, but I guess it's all right.
She paused at the doorway.
You should bring Watt over for dinner sometime soon. And his sister, she added warmly. I'd love to meet them both.
Lita held her mom's gaze as she stretched her web of lies even further. I can bring Watt, but his sister died last year.
Oh, Lita, I'm sorry.
Her mom's face paled, and she swallowed. And Lita knew she had won.
I love you, Mom. Love you, too. I'm proud of you,
Ilara said softly, shutting the door behind her. Lita fell back onto her bed and began composing a message to Watt. Clear your plans for next weekend and pack your bags, she wrote. You're coming with me to Nevada. Rylan followed Shane out of the L.A. train station, which was shaped like an enormous seashell and gleamed a blinding white in the morning sun. She raised her hand automatically to her eyes to shade them, glancing at her new black suitcase, which whirled automatically behind her. Krissa had given it to her as a congratulations on your internship present. Rylan was so excited that she couldn't even argue at the extravagance.
You okay if we head straight to the set? Filming starts in an hour, Shane asked with a glance at Rylan.
He was wearing jeans and a black t-shirt with a single white word on it, though the word was constantly shifting in alphabetical order. So far this morning, Rylan had seen everything from parallel to toast. She wondered how long it took the shirt to cycle through completely and start over again. The two of them had left early that morning on the 8 a.m. train from New York. But since the cross-country trip was only 2 hours, it was now just 7 a.m. in L.A., giving Rylan the curious sensation of having traveled back in time.
Of course, she said quickly.
She'd barely been able to sleep all night from anticipation. She still couldn't quite believe she was going to work on an actual hollow set. As they got into a hover and started off, Rylan glued her eyes to the window, desperate with curiosity about this unfamiliar city. Streets fanned out in various directions, the buildings illuminated and softly curved. Rylan had never seen anywhere like it. It seemed so unnecessarily spread out, with people living and working and going to school in all those different buildings. Rylan expected as much from the suburbs, but wasn't this supposed to be a city? The whole thing struck her as absurdly inefficient. They passed a luxury apartment complex, shiny and new-looking, with glamorous terraces on each level. It was barely 20 floors, yet clearly had been designed for rich people. Rylan didn't know a single wealthy New Yorker who would pay for something this low. What kind of views could it possibly have? Her apartment was on 32, and she guaranteed it was cheaper than anything in this entire neighborhood.
Welcome to L.A., the city of dreamers. Beautiful, yet hopelessly illogical, Shane said as if reading her thoughts.
He sounded both sarcastic and oddly proud.
I'm glad you came, Rylan, he added, and the words traveled pleasantly throughout her body.
She smiled.
Me too.
Suddenly, she thought of Cord's cruel insinuation, the way he'd said that she was taking teacher's pet to a new level. She shifted a little farther from Shane in the tiny space. He didn't seem to notice the movement.
How do people here get around?
She asked, curious.
Medusa.
At Ryland's confused look, Shane gestured up so that the hover's ceiling turned suddenly transparent.
It's an acronym. The Metropolitan Department of Undersphere Air Trams.
The sky overhead was cluttered with an incredibly complicated, tangled system of monorails. They were all colored bright neon, like a glowing nest of snakes. Far above them, she saw the blue arc of the sky. A cartoon clown face appeared against the azure blue, projected with the words, McBurger King, 2-for-1 burgers on Mondays. Ryland gasped.
Oh, have the morning ads already started?
Shane peered up and shrugged.
They project those on the bubble.
Ryland had heard about the bubble. Back before rain was controllable by hydropods, when global warming was still a concern, Los Angeles had worried about their city growing too hot. So they'd bubble-wrapped it, built an enormous supercarbon dome that surrounded the entire city. Years later, once the dome was no longer needed, they refused to take it down. Maybe they'd become too addicted to the ad money, Ryland thought. She pictured the strong, clean lines of the tower, so unlike this cluttered, flashing, chaotic city, and found herself oddly missing it.
Here we are,
Shane said when their hover pulled up to a series of squat, interlocking buildings that could only be the studios. The cavernous soundstage was silent and empty of people. Ryland stole a quick glance at the set. An enormous throne room with marble pillars and a heavy gold dais. Of course. Salve Regina was a historical film about England's final monarch before Britain voted to abolish the whole institution. The lights dimmed, then brightened, then dimmed again as someone, probably the head of photography, tried to perfect the way the light fell on some specific detail. Ryland tried to drink it all in again before Shane turned left and walked through a wall. Her eyes widened, and then she realized that it wasn't a wall at all, but an opaque light divider, to keep all the messiness out of sight of the cameras. She quickly followed into the backstage world of cheerful, disordered chaos. Carts whirled past, laden with sleek metal stylers and brightly colored makeup tubes, funny-looking sketches of noses and eyes and mouths scattered like abandoned limbs. Cameras of various sizes and shapes floated, forgotten, in corners. And into every tiny slice of space were crammed an assortment of people, stage managers and assistants talking frantically into their contacts, a full team of costumers checking every detail of the historic attire, and, of course, the actors and actresses in their full makeuped glory.
Seagrin.
Shane grabbed the arm of a passing young woman who had ebony skin and a wispy bun.
This is Rylan, your new assistant. Rylan, Seagrin is your boss for the week. Good luck, you two.
Okay, thanks. How will I...
find you later? Rylan started to ask, but Shane was already gone, vanished into the horde of clamoring, demanding people. Right, he's in charge of this whole production, she reminded herself. She didn't have first claim on his attention. Didn't have any claim at all, really. But she suddenly found herself longing for the last few hours, when it had been only the two of them on the Hyperloop, and they'd chatted so easily.
You're my new filming assistant? How old are you?
Seagrin wrinkled her nose dubiously. Ryland decided to skirt the truth.
I'm one of Shane's students. He asked me to come help out, she said, deliberately leaving out the part where she was 17.
It's really nice to meet you, she added, and held out a hand. She'd hoped that calling him by his first name would help her sound more professional, but Seagrin just rolled her eyes, exasperated.
One of the high schoolers! Great!
The whole crew actually looked quite young to Rylan. Barely anyone here seemed older than 30. Maybe that was an organic result of Shane's own youth, or maybe he thought having a young crew was crucial to producing a film that was edgy and cool.
What should I get started on?
She asked Seagrin, ignoring the dig. The assistant director rolled her eyes.
Why don't you organize this?
She said curtly, and flung open the door to a massive closet along one wall. It was crammed with what looked like generations of accumulated film paraphernalia. Old pieces of cameras, light boxes, discarded props. Rylan was pretty sure she saw an old box of soda pods in there with one of the dispenser machines. A fine layer of dust covered every surface. This wasn't at all what she'd had in mind when she'd agreed to come work as a filming assistant. She'd thought she would at least be on set, holding lights in place, maybe, or fetching coffee, but standing there watching the action. Rylan looked up at Seagrin's face and saw that she was smirking a little, daring Rylan to challenge her. "I worked my way up from the bottom," Shane had said. Well, Rylan could do it too. She'd been the maid for the Andertons, after all. She wasn't afraid of rolling up her sleeves. "Sounds perfect," she said, and walked into the dim closet to get started. Hours later, Rylan was neck deep in that impossible closet when she realized with a start that the set had grown quiet. It was later than she'd realized. When had everyone else gone home? She grabbed her suitcase, which was still tucked into a corner, and started toward the doorway, thinking she would head back to her assigned room at the crew hotel. It had been a long day, filled with grunt work for Seagrin, organizing that damn closet and picking up lunch from the craft cart and hunting down missing actors in the various break rooms. But Rylan hadn't minded at all, especially not hanging out with the actors. She loved watching them, helping them go over their lines, asking them questions about the filming. She'd realized quickly that the actors were the most talkative of anyone, at least once you got them talking about themselves. A light was still on in one of the edit bays. Rylan hesitated, curious, then walked over to knock boldly at the door.
"What do you want?"
came Shane's irritated voice. "Never mind," Rylan said quickly, stepping back. "I'll just..."
"Rylan, is that you?"
The door swung open and Shane stood there, looking more agitated than Rylan had ever seen him. He was barefoot, and his hair was sticking out wildly every which way. There was a ketchup stain on his t-shirt, which had frozen on the word yesterday.
"I'm sorry, I thought you were someone else. I didn't mean to snap like that."
He kept reaching up to push back his hair, which fell forward over his eyes. "Is everything okay?" Rylan asked, and Shane sighed.
"Not really. I'm just reviewing the dailies, and to be honest..."
He gave an embarrassed shrug.
"They suck."
"Is there anything I can do to help?" Shane seemed surprised by her offer.
"Sure. Come check them out. You'll see what I mean," he warned.
When she'd pulled up the chair next to him, he flicked his wrist, and the footage resumed playing. They watched for a while in silence. The footage wasn't all that bad, Rylan decided, though it wasn't as good as Shane's other films. She tried to focus on certain scenes and images, reminding herself that this was just the raw material, not the finished product. She kept stealing glances at Shane's profile. His eyes gleamed in the dimness, the flickering light of the hollow picking out his strong nose, his firm jaw. Occasionally, his lips moved as he murmured lines of dialogue alongside the actors.
"Okay, look at the Prime Minister here," Shane said abruptly. "She should seem more important. She's about to denounce the Queen in the next scene, but she just disappears in this shot. It's that stupid navy suit we dressed her in."
He lifted a hand to his chin, his eyes narrowed.
"I kept upping the lighting, but that navy suit absorbs photons like a black hole. It has no texture. I'd reshoot it, but we only have her for 2 more days, and I still need to get through Act 3.
Rylan stood up and walked a slow circle around the room. "What about the Queen's gown?" she asked after a moment. "After she walks in, it throws off a lot of light." Shane went silent. For a moment, Rylan feared she'd overstepped her bounds, but then he twirled his finger, skipping forward to the Queen's grand entrance in her elaborate court gown. Rylan watched his face as he watched the scene. When he saw what she meant, his eyes lit up with an almost fanatical fervor.
"You're right," he said wonderingly.
That skirt casts light like a mirror. Look how it brightens the Prime Minister's face and hands.
Can you use it? Ryland pressed.
I'll grab a few of these stills, track all the beams around the PM, and then copy them into the earlier shots. It'll be a bitch to do, but yeah, it'll work.
Shane stood up and stretched his arms overhead, then took a sudden step toward her.
Ryland, that was a fantastic idea. Thank you.
For a panicked moment, Ryland thought he was about to kiss her. Her stomach constricted in a wild, fluttering nervousness. Because he was her teacher, and she knew it was wrong, and yet some tiny part of her wanted him to.
I knew you were a natural.
Shane grinned, then reached for his tablet from the counter behind her and returned to his seat.
I'm ordering coffee. Want anything?
Ryland blinked, startled.
No, thanks, she stammered, to hide her relief. Being around all these self-centered actors was clearly messing with her head.
You should get one. We're going to be here half the night fixing this. Unless you don't want to stay.
Shane quickly backtracked.
You've already worked way more than union hours. But if you don't mind, I could use the help.
Of course I'm staying, Ryland said firmly and sat up straighter.
And actually, yeah, a coffee would be great. Awesome.
Shane clicked on the tablet a few times to place their orders, then smiled at Ryland as the footage began again. Avery. Avery was tapping her stylus on her tablet, frowning down at a physics problem, when a knock sounded at her door. For a glorious, terrible instant, she thought it might be Atlas, before she remembered that they weren't speaking. And besides, Atlas's knock had always been louder and more self-assured.
Yeah?
She turned around, one leg crossed over the other in her chair. Her mom paused in the doorway. She was wearing a red and black day dress with tights and a cropped black jacket.
I just wanted to make sure you knew about dinner, she said, smiling. Sarah is cooking short ribs.
Avery's eyes widened.
What are we celebrating? Did Dad already figure out his next project?
Genuine short ribs, the kind that weren't grown in labs, were hard to come by and, even for the Fullers, implied a special occasion, usually a new real estate acquisition.
Atlas is officially taking the Dubai job. He and your father negotiated all the details,
Elizabeth exclaimed. She gave a little laugh, as if the idea of Atlas negotiating his salary with his own father was too amusing. So, Avery thought. That explained why both her parents' spirits had visibly lifted these past few days. She'd known this was coming, yet the news still stung her more than it should.
I wish I could, she said immediately. But it's actually Risha's birthday, and we're all going out to dinner.
No way was she staying here with her parents and Atlas, pretending to toast to the news that threatened to shatter her already broken heart into even smaller pieces.
Really, do you have to?
Elizabeth pressed, but Avery held firm.
It's her birthday, Mom. I'm sorry.
Her mom finally nodded and shut the door. Avery wandered mechanically into her bathroom to splash water on her face, then grabbed a towel from the UV sanitizer to pat it dry. The touch-activated floor was warm on her bare feet. Her counter was enormous, lined in pristine white marble, not a fingerprint or smudge in sight. And all around her were mirrors, curved mirrors, flat mirrors, even an antique hand mirror that her grandmother had given her on her first birthday. They were positioned at all angles, as if Avery might need to constantly check herself from new and unexpected perspectives. Normally, Avery switched the mirrors to project an ocean view. She hated the way her mom had decorated this bathroom, made Avery the focus of it, just as she was the centerpiece of the rest of their lives. But now she leaned forward on her palms and studied her reflection. A ghost-like self, pale and hollow-eyed, looked back at her. She watched the ghost tap a series of commands into her makeup diffuser, making Avery beautiful, it seemed, without any help from her actual self. She closed her eyes as a fine mist sprayed over her face, instantly brightening the shadows around her eyes, darkening her lashes, highlighting the sweeping architecture of her cheekbones. When she looked up, she felt almost like Avery Fuller again. She reached for the jasmine lotion in its crystal dispenser and rubbed it over her bare arms. It had been a gift from Eris, who used to order it from a tiny boutique in the Philippines and always smelled like it. The scent was soothing and so painfully familiar that it made Avery want to cry. Eris would have understood this feeling, Avery thought, the sensation that there was a terrifying emptiness inside her, where something sharp and brittle rattled hollowly. Probably the broken pieces of her heart. Eris would have hugged Avery and assured her that she was better than the rest of them combined. She would have sat with her eating cookie bites and hiding from the world until Avery felt ready to face it again. But Eris wasn't here, and Avery had to get out of this apartment if she wanted to avoid seeing Atlas tonight. Compose Flicker. To Risha, Jess, she hesitated a moment, and Ming. Avery still resented Ming for the way she'd embarrassed Eris at her birthday party, but she wanted a lot of people around her right now, and Ming was the type of person you needed on nights like this, loud and game for anything, with a flair for the dramatic. If nothing else, Ming would help keep Avery from thinking about Atlas. We're going out tonight. Dress up. Meet at Ichi at 8.
What's going on? Jess asked when they were seated at Ichi a few hours later.
Despite the late notice, all three girls had shown up, as Avery knew they would. Avery tugged nervously at her laser-cut black dress and reached for the platter of lobster tempura on the table before them. Ichi was a trendy sushi restaurant, an old favorite of Eris's, nestled like an opulent gem in the center of the 941st floor. It had no exterior windows, but that worked perfectly with the clubby atmosphere. Dim lighting, techno music, and especially the low-slung tables that forced everyone to sit on the ground amid piles of red silk cushions.
I just wanted to have a fun girls' night, she said, flashing a smile. It's a Wednesday, Risha pointed out.
I am avoiding my parents, Avery decided to admit. They wanted to have a big family dinner at home, but I'm upset with them and not in the mood. I don't want to get into it, she added. And Ming, who'd already opened her mouth to ask a question, reluctantly stayed silent. A waiter swooped over with the rest of their order. Eel sashimi, tartare tacos, an enormous baked miso souffle. When he started to deposit bright purple drinks at the corner of each place setting, Avery looked up in surprise. We didn't order lychee martinis.
I did, Ming announced, and turned to Avery with a challenging smile.
Come on, you know you want one. Avery started to protest. She wasn't in the mood to drink at all. But then she thought of Atlas, sitting there with her parents, toasting to the job she'd never wanted him to take. One drink wouldn't hurt. The girls were all looking at Avery, awaiting her judgment.
Okay, she said, lifting the martini to her lips. Let's take a snap, Jess squealed.
Avery started to shift aside like she normally did. She'd always hated being in snaps. She couldn't control how the images made their way through the feeds, never knew who saw them, and despite all that effort, there were far more pics out there than she wanted. But tonight, something stopped her. Maybe it wouldn't be such a bad thing if Atlas saw her out right now with her friends. Maybe it would start making things normal between them.
Here, take one with me in it, she said,
her voice ringing strange even to her own ears. She felt slippery with anxiety.
Of course.
Ming pulled her lips into a tight, angular smile as the other girls turned and posed with practiced ease.
But Avery, you never want to be in snaps. Who are you trying to make jealous?
Ming demanded, suspicious.
Everyone,
Avery said easily, and they all laughed, even Ming. Avery leaned back and glanced around the room. Everyone here was young and well-dressed, their skin bright with the elusive glow of wealth. A few boys at other tables glanced their way, clearly wondering about the young women in their short dresses and long, glittery earrings, but no one had yet ventured over to talk to them.
"Risha!"